Today on the docket is United States v. Reese. We'll hear first from the appellant.
Morning again, members of the court. Your Honors, my name is William Casera, and along with Jason Roberts, we represent the appellant in this case, Petty Officer Shane E. Reese. As you know, the court has asked for argument on two issues, the first of which is that the military judge erred in allowing the government to make a major change to a specification after the complaining witness's testimony did not support the offense as originally charged. Some quick background information for the court. As you know, the first outcry in this case was in June of 2013 when EV alleged inter alia that the appellant licked his penis. In a July 2013 forensic interview, EV said he couldn't remember anything except that the appellant bothered him in a bedroom and told him to get naked. In an October 2013 forensic interview, EV said the appellant touched him on his tushy with his hand. The charges were preferred on February 18, 2014, alleging a myriad of sexual assaults, one of which was not a touching of the penis with his hand. But the one that was charged, and that which is in question in this case, is that the appellant was charged with licking the penis of EV with his tongue. The EV did not testify at the Article 32 hearing, and at a pretrial motion on April 22, 2014, to litigate the admission of residual hearsay, the military judge denied the government's motion. On November 11, 2014, 2 days before trial, or excuse me, the day before trial, with both the trial counsel and the defense counsel present, EV testified that the appellant touched his penis with his hand. He denied all other contact. And it is important to note that nobody, the trial counsel, nor the defense counsel, nor the law enforcement, had ever interviewed EV. At a at an Article 39A session on November 13, 2014, after EV's deposition, the appellant changed his forum selection from a panel to military judge alone. On the third day of trial, EV testified that appellant touched his penis with his hands, that it was, quote, a really quick touching, and he denied all other contact.
So, counsel, we have the same offense, same accused, same victim, same dates, same penalty, same defense used. So why is this not a minor change?
Well, I would disagree with you that we have the same defense used. We have, major differences or major changes in the defense strategy. The first of which was the forum selection. This was a case in which the appellant had originally chose to go with a panel based on the myriad of the charged offenses. The second of which is, had this case been charged as a touching only, the defense likely would have been an accidental or an inadvertent touching, which is a completely different approach to the approach that they took at trial.
In terms of the forum selection issue, going forward in future cases, if we were to focus on that, wouldn't a defense counsel always be able to claim, well, we would have gone with a different form, because we would never be able to go behind that assertion to determine whether that, in fact, was part of the equation in terms of form selection?
Well, there's really no way to know that for certain unless the opponent has asked that question on the record. But in this case, Part of the equation that the court should consider in determining the standard of whether or not this is a significant change is the fact that it happened in mid-trial. And so while the military judge referred to this as a minor change, and it sort of also looks like a possible variance issue, it's really neither of the two. It is a change in the indictment, and contrary to the Supreme Court precedent, that it is a change in the methodology that was used. And this court will recall that in the Longmire case, the means of committing the offense changed and the surrounding facts changed. And this court found that that was a major change. Well, if the means and the of the committing the offense and the surrounding facts in Longmire were significant enough, a change from licking the penis when the child is naked in one room to briefly touching the penis while the child is clothed in another room is certainly a completely different charge.
Well, counsel, but the manual says that a change that reduces the exposure is a minor change. I mean, one could philosophize about leaking versus touching, but it does seem that leaking is there's very little one could do to argue inadvertent leaking. There's a substantial amount one could do to argue inadvertent touching. Therefore, isn't this something that favored the defense and therefore by definition in the manual is a minor change?
Well, that's only one of the prongs of the test, for lack of a better term, Your Honor, in terms of whether something is a minor change, which is whether or not it lessens or increases the punishment. But another one is when it is material and substantially prejudicial to the accused. And we would argue that that is certainly the case in the instant case, because the entire gravamen of the offense changed. And while the manual draws this line of demarcation as pre- or post-arraignment, okay, and obviously this happened post-arraignment, but the difference in this case, Judge, and part of what, again, is one of the factors that we believe the court should consider in determining whether this is a major or a minor change, is that prong of the test announced in Marshall, which is a variance is fatal when it is material and substantially prejudicial to the accused. So while the manual draws that line of demarcation between pre- and post-arraignment, the facts of this case are that it happened so far post-arraignment and in the middle of trial that it was material and substantially prejudicial to the accused.
Simply temporally?
I guess the quote from the case.
Yeah, no, but I mean, is that what you're arguing?
Yes.
You're arguing not the nature of it. You're arguing that it happened so late that it's what? Per se prejudicial?
I wouldn't say per se prejudicial, Your Honor, because, for example, I could conceive of a case in which an accused is charged with, you know, stealing $500 worth of material, and it turns out the material is worth less than $500, and the court might say, well, that's an exception and substitution that does not materially prejudice the accused, and I don't think any accused would complain about that. But if you look at the Murray case, the Air Force case, where the means of the crime changed from hitting somebody with a club to hitting somebody with a gun, striking somebody with a gun, the court said that that was a material and substantially prejudicial change.
So how are you defining prejudice in this instance?
I'm defining prejudice in two ways, Your Honor, the change in forum selection and the change in the means of presenting the defense. I think those are the two main areas we would ask the court to look at.
Mr. Casera, can you help me out with the factual lead up to the trial. Now, I understand that there was a deposition. They didn't get to interview the child, but there was a deposition 2 days before, right?
Yes.
And presumably the defense counsel was at the deposition.
He was, Your Honor.
Now, I thought, but correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't remember, but I thought at the deposition the child indicated a touching rather than a licking.
He did, Your Honor.
Okay, so wouldn't that have put defense counsel on notice that the testimony was going to be different than that what was alleged?
I think that it would put the defense counsel on notice of the possibility that the testimony would be different, but it is not the defense counsel's responsibility to plan for every exigency and every possibility. In fact, Your Honor, our argument would be that that put the government on notice and that the proper remedy at that point is to re-prefer and to reinvestigate the charge.
Right, I understand that, and I would agree with you there. But as far as the defense counsel is concerned, what I'm trying to fix in my own mind is, from a prejudice standpoint, if your position on prejudice is that you would have had a different strategy, wouldn't that have occurred to defense counsel at the deposition or afterwards, that there might be a change here? I may need to tweak my defensive approach to the case?
But the licking, I would agree in a
general
sense.
And I'm asking.
No, I understand, Your Honor. And I would say that in a general sense, that may be true in some cases. But in this particular case, the licking was still charged. So that was the offense that the appellant was still taking. We would argue that that actually inures to the appellant's defense or to the appellant's benefit in this case, because after that deposition, the government doesn't move to change the charge. They wait until 3 days into the trial to move to change the charge, which leaves the defense in the position of thinking, we're still defending against the licking charge.
Okay, so you're saying basically even though the child had indicated one kind of offense or touching or contact, shall we say, that it didn't necessarily mean that the charged or the alleged contact had not also taken place.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, I get it.
And it is also true because, as you recall, the government counsel said we are making this decision based on the new charge that came up yesterday. I mean, the government themselves at trial indicated that this was a new charge.
All right, well, let me ask you this, too, while I have it in my mind, because I'd likely forget here 10 minutes from now.
Happens to me every day, Judge.
Well, I can't say it happens to me every day, but you're older than I am.
I'll take your word for it.
All right. My question is this. Now, when this issue arises at the trial, they take a recess, do they not?
Yes.
And I think it's over the weekend, isn't it?
No.
How long
is it? The recess occurred after the change. The recess occurred after his testimony.
Right.
The government moved for the change after the weekend recess. The military judge allowed them, I think, 4 hours to do some research and submit briefs on the issue.
Right, but what I'm trying to fix in my mind here is the issue arises when the child testifies. And it seems like there's enough time afterwards, including over the weekend, for defense counsel to do whatever they're going to do to get ready to confront this new change in the testimony. And I'm looking at it from a prejudice standpoint. And I'm assuming that if there is a problem here, if this is a major change, that we test for prejudice, I assume that we do.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So that's where my mind is right now.
Yes, sir.
And so I'd like you to help me out here. As far as this recess and then over the weekend, and what defense counsel might not have been able to do.
Well, if you put yourself in the shoes of the defense counsel, they're probably walking out of court on Friday thinking the government has not proven their case. We're in good shape.
So they're ready to move.
They're ready to continue on to defend the charged allegation.
Or move under 917, maybe?
I'm sorry? Yes.
Or maybe they're thinking.
For a motion under 917.
Right.
So this was a major change because it was not fairly included in those previously preferred. The amendment changed the means of the offense. The facts changed from oral sodomy while naked in a bedroom in the appellant's house to a quick touching of the penis. The government did not foresee this change. Therefore, the appellant should not be on, should not inure to the detriment of the appellant. The defense likely would have changed. The government position at trial likely would have changed. And we would argue that this is analogous to Murray and Longmire. Subject to any further questions from the members of the court, I'd like to move on to the second specified issue.
Please do.
Thank you, Your Honor. The specification of the additional charge fails to state an offense where the terminal element failed to allege words of criminality and where the alleged conduct fell within a listed offense of Article 134 UCMJ. As the court knows, under Clause 2 of Article 134, an offense has two elements. The accused did or failed to do a certain act, and that under the circumstances, the accused's conduct was service discrediting. The specification fails to state an offense because the terminal element did not allege words of criminality that sufficiently stated the mens rea requirement to make the appellant's speech criminal. Fossler says that the words of criminality may be required in an Article 134 offense depending on the conduct. So this court has asked, this court has stated without words of criminality, the specification merely states that an appellant made a statement and that the conduct or the speech was criminal. We don't have any words of criminality to state the necessary mens rea of what is otherwise innocent conduct. Specification is also defective because we would argue that it is preempted under Article 134, obstructing justice, the elements of which are fairly included in what the appellant was charged with here. The charged offense alleges that the appellant wrongfully influenced or wrongfully intimidated EV by means of intimidation delayed or prevented the communication of relating to the alleged sexual abuse. By using a novel specification for conduct already addressed by a listed offense, the government only had to prove that the appellant did a certain act and that his conduct was service discrediting. The government saves itself the burden of proving the elements under obstruction of justice. This was error. The error was plain and obvious because it failed to include words of criminality in an offense involving speech and because the conduct fell under obstructing justice. It was prejudicial because the appellant was not on notice of the mens rea requirement. I think the best analogy that I could give this court is, in my last 30 seconds, if I were to tell this court If three of you don't vote for me, I'm going to lose this case. That is a matter of fact. That is certainly not a threat to any members of this court that you better vote for me. I've learned over the years that I don't, you know, I'm smart enough, at least, and an old enough judge to not to know I can't do that. We believe that that is exactly what happened in this case. Subject to any further questions from the members of the court, this concludes the appellant's initial presentation.
Could I ask a question that maybe you can, Chief Judge, you can come back on rebuttal and maybe give me the answer here. my question is, the preemption doctrine itself, does it apply within the listed offenses under Article 134 of the manual, or is the doctrine limited to application between an enumerated offense statutorily and offenses under Article 134? In other words, was the idea that we don't want folks using Article 134 to charge made-up offenses that otherwise look like they should be charged under statutory offense?
I can answer that now or just come back?
No, just come back.
Yes, sir. We'll do, Your Honor. Thank you, Member of the Court.
Thank you.
I hear from the government.
Good morning again, Your Honors. I'm Lieutenant Commander Teresa Holy, and along with Mr. Stephen McCleary, I represent the United States. This court should affirm because the change to Charge 3, Specification 3, was minor, and in any case did not prejudice the appellant. Also, the specification under the additional charge is sufficient because it contains the elements of Article 134 and provides adequate notice.
Okay, counsel, so we go from a charge of licking the minor's penis with circumstances being naked in the bedroom. We have the evidence actually introduced at trial. We're in the middle of trial, and it really shows a touching while clothed in the living room, and we have the trial counsel referring to it as a new charge. Why under 603 should this court say minor change?
Under 603, and as this court prescribed in Sullivan, the standard of review is de novo. So we're really looking at it as a minor change that changed only the licking to a touching. The test is that there's no substantial matter not fairly included in the offenses previously preferred, and also that there was no unfair surprise. In United States versus Moreno, this court said that the real issue in change classification offenses is notice. And they preface the prejudice argument by stating that prejudice can be avoided by asking for a continuance. So in these cases, an amendment made before trial is unlikely to be held to injure the substantial rights of the accused where the continuance was either granted or not requested. And importantly,
now, wouldn't that notice really be effective immediately prior to trial, but after you've had the evidence introduced, you're in the middle of trial, essentially the government is saying, I want a do-over. I charged you this way. Evidence doesn't support me. Now guess what? I want a change of the charge. How can we say notice cures this?
In Moreno, this court said the manual recognizes that pretrial preparation or evidence at trial may require amendments to specifications. The time window provided by RCM 603 extends from arraignment until the finding, so it does contemplate that changes could be made at any time during this time period and would be analyzed the same.
So what about the forum change? I mean, the appellant argues that after the deposition, they made the decision based on other things, to request a judge-alone trial, and then the testimony changed. The testimony was the same at trial, and by that point, they had made the forum change. When the judge allowed the charge to change, it's too late for them to go back and redo that. How can the government argue that that didn't have an influence on the defense strategy? The horse is out of the barn. You can't put it back in.
And other service courts, Your Honor, have focused on the issue of the ability to present a defense. No case has focused specifically on saying that forum selection is an indicator. Certainly, notice is a driving factor in deciding whether there's prejudice, but the notice is of what is going to be presented at trial.
But forum selection is a substantial strategic right of the defendant, and they make that based upon what they see that is coming in the trial. And if they make it based upon situation A and later, after they've made it, situation B occurs, the amendment is allowed.
Yes, Your Honor, I And forum selection is one of the many strategic decisions that the defense needs to make, and as contemplated by 603, certainly it's a decision that the defense always has to make without knowing exactly what's going to occur in trial. But there are five ways that we can know that the defense was not unfairly surprised in this case. Importantly is where the parties were in trial when this change was made. This change was made essentially on day three of trial, on date after the deposition, after the forum selection, and it's important to know which witnesses went before the change and which witnesses went after. Before the change testified a Coast Guard Investigative Service agent that just gave some general investigative information and described that the appellant had denied the conduct when questioned. Two Coast Guard supervisors of the appellant testified simply to establish that the appellant's work schedule would have permitted him an opportunity to be alone with the child. The child testified, as the court is aware, and then a civilian detective that merely said that he was present during one of the child's forensic interviews and saw that the child was sad, and the civilians didn't go forward. So that is the extent of the government's case at the time the change was made. The witnesses that went after are significant. The child's parents testified. The expert witness that the government had testified. One of the forensic interviewers testified. And then the defense presented its entire case knowing that the judge had granted this change, and that included Evie being recalled at the judge's invitation, calling the appellant's wife, and the appellant's decision to testify. So many full knowledge not only of the conduct, but of what the charge is that he's facing.
What weight should we give to the fact that just as the defense was on notice before trial, the government was on notice before trial, the charges are completely within the purview of the government, and the government could have gone forward with new charges that more accurately reflected what the evidence was going to show here. What weight should we give to that?
Traditionally, Your Honor, this court has not focused on what is in the mind of the government or what the government should or should not have done. In general, the court has strictly applied the test in Sullivan. Is there a substantial matter not fairly included, and was the appellant unfairly
surprised? But in this case, the government had the ability and was on notice that they could have cured the problem by either re-referring prior to going in. They knew when the deposition was given that the testimony was different. And for whatever reason, they went ahead kind of gambling, I guess, that the testimony would change. But once they went ahead, why can't the defense rely on what the government did to say, okay, this is the case. They've decided not to do anything.
Your Honor, that would be the situation in any case where a change is made in the middle of trial as contemplated by 603. Certainly, when you go into trial with one specification and a change is made, that's different from what went
but,
in.
But changes are made oftentimes when everybody is kind of surprised. And, I mean, certainly the government was surprised because they referred to this as a new charge. Had they known it was a new charge before, you think they would have charged it. But they did know before, and they didn't charge it. So that's why I'm wondering, why can't the defense, all of this is a very fluid situation, why can't the defense rely on that?
I mean, the purpose of the rule, counsel, isn't to allow the government to change things in the middle of trial because they weren't able to prove charge. Right? I mean, it's generally supposed to be there for like minor things. Like minor things. Like you misnamed the appellant. Like you got the date wrong by one day. Right? Something like that. Not you failed to prove it. And then you change it to conform to what you did prove.
That would be part of the prong of the Sullivan test of unfair surprise, and this court would simply look to whether or not, based on the record, the appellant was unfairly surprised by the change. In this case,
I'm talking about whether it was a major change versus a minor change, and whether the judge could do what he did over the defense's objection at all, right?
So whether, Your Honor, a substantial matter not fairly included in the charges previously preferred, this falls into that part of the test. This case is most similar to United States versus Moreno. In terms of the change that was made. And in that case, the change that was made was the specification preferred alleged a conspiracy to distribute drugs, and the day before trial there was a change to the overt act that was committed as part of this conspiracy. And this court focused on notice and said the essential fact that there was a conspiracy, there's a meeting of the minds, is still there. The only thing that changed...
That was before trial. That wasn't in the middle of trial. What they charged.
Yes, Your Honor, the change was made before trial in that case.
You don't see why that would be different.
Your Honor, this court should apply the same test. There's never been a dividing line in either 6 or 03 or in this court's precedent that says that we should treat changes that are made at different points in the trial differently, except when the time window for 603 changes is closed and then you move into variance. That is one time period, and we submit that the analysis remains the same. Certainly, the point in trial could affect how much the defense is able to adjust their case. They can adjust their case more before trial than they can for witnesses.
Well, and can't the temporal point affect prejudice?
It can. Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. I think that's the point it's trying to be made here, that the appellant is trying to make here, that this happened so late that it aggravated its effect, and that therefore, among other things, he was prejudiced. And the government's response to that is?
There are other places that we can look to demonstrate that the appellant was not prejudiced.
Yeah, well, let me hear how the appellant was not prejudiced.
Yes, Your Honor. The defense strategy nor the government strategy did not change after the minor change was made. The defense strategy was always that the appellant did not do it because he simply did not have an opportunity to be alone with the child. And the government's case was always that the appellant had committed a lewd act upon this 4-year-old boy. In addition, at the time that the change was made, the military judge offered remedies and the defense availed themselves of it. The remedies were a continuance for the rest of the day. The ruling came down at 1300 and the judge said, well, how long do you need? Is the end of the day okay? And the defense said yes. They accepted that continuance and did not ask for any further ones. The military judge said, would you like to recall any of the witnesses, including UV? And the defense said, yes, we would like to recall UV. And they did so. They didn't ask to recall any of the law enforcement agents or the supervisors that had previously testified. When they recalled UV, they didn't explore any different theory. For example, as the appellate counsel has alluded, he didn't explore a theory of whether there was a touching for a legitimate purpose. Simply explored whether the child had other sources of sexualized knowledge, whether his memory was poor, or whether his parents had coached him to say particular things.
Counsel, can I turn your attention, please, to issue number 2?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where is the criminal intent found within that charge?
As the Supreme Court set out in Alonis, mens rea exists in every criminal offense, whether or not the statute says it. And where a statute is silent to it, but in Alonis, the court, through de novo analysis, may find it in various places. In the context of military cases, there have been various places where this court and service courts have found mens rea. In Rappert, for example, this court did find the mens rea required for a communicating of a threat charge in or wrongfully in that threat, in the specification itself.
But in this charge, there wasn't anything having to do with wrongfully, there wasn't any requirement of knowledge about a pending criminal investigation. There wasn't any requirement for obstruction of justice. So looking at the charge here, where do we find the criminal intent?
The court could look to its decision in Caldwell and treat this case similarly. In Caldwell, this court was looking at Article 93 maltreatment and essentially said, under Alonis, what we need to do is separate innocent conduct from criminal conduct and read into this statute only the mens rea required to do so. And a similar analysis could be undertaken here. What's the key element that separates innocent conduct from wrongful conduct? And in this specification, the specification itself contained 4 elements that separated innocent conduct from wrongful conduct. And those are the if-then dichotomy that's presented. The accused tells the child, if you tell, then these negative consequences will happen, thereby putting it on the child to either bring about or prevent the negative consequences.
But how would that be different if it's a purely benign statement on the part of a service member? To use it somewhat in the same context, kid is being babysitted by the accused. The accused puts him in timeout, and the kid's screaming bloody murder about it. And the accused says, if you tell anybody, I'm going to go to jail. I mean, that's not criminal conduct.
It's not, Your Honor, and that goes to the second part in the specification that separates the conduct from innocent conduct, and that is the what the accused has done. So the accused has done something, and the reference to jail. Then the third element that separates it from innocent conduct is that there is something false in that statement. This is not simply, if you
there's something what in that statement?
There is something false, Your Honor. And the falsehood is that the child's auntie, who is the child's babysitter and very dear to him, will also go to jail if the child tells.
Okay, but I still, I'm not looking for, and I appreciate your grasp of Alonis and Caldwell and Raper. I'm not looking for an analysis, though. I'm just asking you, what is the criminal intent? What are you saying it is? Wrongfully?
General intent, Your Honor, similarly to in Caldwell. Because if the accused knows that he's doing each of these four things, speaking directly to a four-year-old, saying these words, giving an offended dichotomy, and telling a lie, then that separates his
conduct. But how does general intent separate wrongful conduct from innocent conduct in this context?
Your Honor, is that we don't want to criminalize, for example, completely innocent or even negligent conduct. One danger would be, for example, if the child simply overhears the accused saying these things, that would be a concern that that might be innocent conduct. But that's satisfied by having the specification state he's speaking directly to the child.
But are you saying
what's the underlying crime?
I mean, if the crime is he was trying to obstruct justice, he was trying to influence the kid, then he should have charged it as obstruction of justice, right? And, but he didn't. So what's the crime?
The crime, Your Honor, is to state to this child who he has just sexually abused these words that put on him guilt or basically put it in his court to prevent or bring about negative circumstances, this four-year-old child that he has just sexually abused and that conduct was service to.
Well, it seems to me this is an ipso facto. He said something, therefore it was service discrediting. I mean, you've striven mightily to get this somewhere. I don't get it. I don't get it. And I echo Judge Ryan. If you wanted to charge obstruction of justice, you should have charged obstruction of justice, leaving aside the preemption issue. You should have charged it, but that's got two more elements that this got the government out of proving. And the element you seem to be saying we should imply those elements because it's naughty to make a kid feel bad or something along those lines. Where are we?
This specification is most like Caldwell, and there isn't...
Is most like what?
Most like Caldwell. We agree that there isn't... The negative consequence is not set out in the specification like it would be in other places. However, because there are four things that separate this conduct from criminal conduct, and those things are in the mind of the accused. But as mentioned, that would separate it from innocent conduct, and under Davis, the criminality of it would be inferred also from the terminal element.
Let's move to the second argument, and that is paragraph 60C6C of the manual, which certainly seems to indicate that the government can't use a novel specification to allege under Clause 2 of Article 134, an offense that is specifically listed in Article 134. This is separate from preemption, which is under paragraph 60C5A. This applies to a novel theory, a novel charge that is already enumerated under Article 134. Why doesn't that apply here?
Analyzing it, Your Honor, as a rule, whether the president is in fact saying when the president couches it as an option, if it's not covered here, then it may be a novel 134 Is this court asking whether we should read the inverse and say, well, if it is here, you can't charge it as a novel 134?
I'm asking, why isn't that a logical interpretation? When you read that rule.
So, for example, like larceny has elements, okay? Let's say you can't meet one of the elements, right, because you just can't. You can't charge it as a novel Article 134 thing, saying that it would have been larceny if you had these other things.
Yes, Your Honor, and we would agree that the President has specifically stated, and in McGinnis, this court said, that you have preemption when you're talking about...
I'm not talking about preemption. I'm talking about this. You're trying to make out an obstruction of justice charge, apparently. You're missing some of the elements, right? And so you charge it as an Article 134 offense. What I'm saying is, why do you think you can do that? I mean, you guys, I know you don't try that many cases a year, but like the ones that you do are always a mess. I mean, you come up with the most novel problems known to mankind in these cases.
Your Honor, I would point to two things that support the flexibility to use the novel 134 even when there's a similar offense that the President has otherwise prescribed. One is 1003A, which provides for finding the maximum punishment when you have similar offenses, and the other is the need for flexibility as shown in United States versus Hackler and explained by the ACCA in Guardado. We need the flexibility to criminalize a wide variety of conduct. And that
so like larceny, things have to have a certain value, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so let's say that an accused took something that had no value. Do you think that you could allege all the elements of larceny except the value and that would be okay under Article 134?
No, Your Honor, that would be typical preemption under McGinnis. Congress has spoken as to larceny, so that would be actual preemption and would be prohibited.
So why isn't this the same thing?
Because Congress has not spoken to obstruction of justice. The President was merely giving an example of how 134 might apply in that circumstance, and the flexibility exists to explain how, in different circumstances, that would also apply.
So the government's position, with regard to Judge Erdman's question, 60C, 6B, whatever it is, the government's position is, well, yeah, but we need flexibility, so let us be flexible. Is that it, basically? Because that provision seems to say that you can't make it up. You can't make it up when there's I don't want to call it an enumerated, but there's an offense set out under 134 by the President. You can't say, well, yeah, this is really that, but we can't prove this. So, you know, the manual seems to say you can't do that.
That, Your Honor, is that the President's instruction there is not proscriptive. It's simply saying, if you don't find it here, you can use the novel 134. It doesn't say the inverse. And second, the typical preemption analysis found in...
Well, it's but again, it's not preemption in the strict sense. That's something else. Okay, thank you.
Hey, Lieutenant Commander Olley, weren't you a lieutenant when you wrote the brief?
I was, yes, Your Honor.
Oh, so you got recently promoted? Oh, when did you get promoted?
It was
January, sir. Oh, well, congratulations.
Thank you.
But that aside, my question is this. I understand that at one point, maybe during the Article 32 or afterwards, the theory was that this offense was alleging communicating a threat. And isn't the whole problem here, I mean, isn't the reason why the President set out these illicit offenses is so you don't have this problem where when you come up with a novel specification that people can't figure out what it is, or it's communicating a threat or it's obstruction of justice, and that's why they set these offenses out. Isn't that some of the reason for this, so that you preclude some of this kind of confusion?
It is, Your Honor, absolutely.
And doesn't the government bear the responsibility and the burden that if they decide to come up with one of these novel specifications, that they must be careful to allege all of the criminal acts, all of the elements, and any words of criminality? Wouldn't you agree with that?
That is what this court required in Vaughn, yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, but that doesn't seem to have taken place here, and I'm simply, I guess, restating what everyone before me has stated. That seems to be the problem.
Yes, Your Honor. May I briefly conclude?
Do you agree that the conduct that you're concerned with does fall within obstruction of justice, right, which is that he said these words to keep the kid from telling anyone?
Yes, Your Honor. It's similar to that offense.
So why, I think this is the same thing that Judge Irwin was talking about, where they talk about the fact that you can create a novel spec if the conduct isn't already covered by an Article 134 offense. So if the conduct is already covered by an Article 134 offense, why do you think you get to make up a novel specification? I mean, I think because what you did is you created one that took out the parts that made it criminal.
Yes, Your Honor, if you were looking at this as a novel specification under 134, simply have to look for, are the elements of 134 there? Do you have words of criminality? And do you have notice of criminality? And those things are found in obstruction of justice, but the court can also find them by analyzing this particular specification. And nothing.
I think this is a slightly different question, which is if the things that the person did are already covered by obstruction of justice, query, why do you think you can create a novel specification just leaving out some of the elements, some of the acts that were already listed? Do you understand the difference?
Yes, Your Honor. And our position is that the paragraph 60 in the manual does not prohibit doing so, and the specification would survive if it met the requirements independently analyzed as a novel spec.
Counsel, you may briefly conclude.
In conclusion, this court should affirm because the change to charge 3 specification 3 was minor and did not prejudice the appellant, and the specification under the additional charge is sufficient because it contains the elements of Article 134, provides adequate notice, and is not preempted or prohibited.
Thank you. We'll now hear rebuttal.
Thank you, members of the court. Judge Sparks, I wanted to get to your question first.
Thank you.
Which was with regards to the preemption question. The conduct falls under a listed offense. And we believe that the preemption, and we're talking about specifically 134 offenses, we believe that the preemption doctrine prohibits the use of a novel spec to proscribe the exact same conduct. And the reason for that is, if you look at the Hackler case, says that if conduct by an accused does not fall under any of the listed offenses, a specification used in this manual may be used to allege that offense. So in other words, if it's not otherwise listed in the manual, then you get to use the unenumerated, or for lack of a better term, Judge Stuckey, the other offenses under 134. But then obviously if it is listed under 134, then you don't just get to just pick something out of thin air and say this is what it is. Well, I think it is, Your Honor, in the sense of if there's another offense within 134, then that preempts your ability to charge a novel spec that is already criminal under 134.
But usually when we talk about preemption, we talk about 60C5A in Articles 80 to 132.
Well, no, I would agree, Judge. I think
you could say it's a limitation in Article 4, but I mean it's different than preemption because that's a precise legal doctrine that has specifically.
I understand the court's point, Your Honor. I think that either way we can put a tag on it, but I think either way what the government did was prohibited in this case. And moving back to the first issue. Judge Stuckey, I believe you asked, or maybe it was Judge Olson, aren't what we essentially doing in this case is giving the government a do-over. And that is exactly what happened in this case. We can't prove our case, so we get a do-over. And the government cites the Moreno case, but I think it's important to remember in Moreno that first off, the change to the specification happened the day before trial, but two, what they were changing was the overt act as opposed to the offense itself. Those are very significant differences that we do not have in this case. And I think it's also important, I believe, correct me if I don't know which one of the five of you raised this issue, but I think it was Judge Olson, the government gets to pick how they do this. The government picked how they charge this case. They charged this case in every way that they thought was possibly criminal. They charged him with a number of Article 120B offenses. What they did not charge him with was what he was eventually put on trial for and convicted of, which is the height of unfair prejudice to the accused. As we noted, the forum change is part of the prejudice, and
the people who should have known all along are the people who charge this case, and that is the government.
Mr. Honor, you may not know this because I'm assuming you didn't. You weren't at the trial. You weren't the trial attorney. But is it clear anywhere in the record that this child's change of testimony was a complete surprise? Or I think we've kind of been taking the tack that, well, it may have been a surprise to the defense counsel, but the question is, was it really a surprise to the government? Were they just as surprised? Was this a surprise to everybody, or do we not know that?
Your Honor, I don't know if that's in the record, but I'm happy to file a supplemental.
No. I thought you might recall.
My recollection is that back in April, the government had some notice as to the touching offense. And I forget from where that comes, but it is also my recollection that they had not, they've talked to investigators in the case. They had not talked to the child. But it's my recollection that back in April, 6 months prior to trial, from those talks with the investigators, they had some notice that the child's testimony may be that the touching was the only act that occurred. But I can't. I gave Judge Ryan a 50-50 chance yesterday, and I was wrong on that. I could very well be wrong on that. I understand.
Don't take you to Vegas.
If you ask my wife, I'm wrong a lot more than 50% of the time, but that's another story. So subject to any further questions from the members of the court, the appellant's position is that this was a major change that substantially prejudiced the accused and that the additional specification does not allege an offense, and therefore, for those reasons, the appellant's conviction should be overturned.
I have just a real quick question.
Yes, ma'am.
About the prejudice issue. The rule says that if it's a major change, that it needs to be re-referred.
Yes, Your Honor.
So if it was a major change, what's the status of that offense?
That is a very good question, Your Honor. And the honest question is, I don't know. And the reason for that is because,
Right, because, basically, it's a nullity.
We are creatures of...
If it's a major change. Article 32.
Then there's an argument that this court did not even have jurisdiction to try that offense, in which case it would be a nullity. Thank you, members of the court. It's been a pleasure. We'll see you next time around. Judge Sparks, it was my pleasure to meet you, sir.
Yes, sir. Likewise.
No, this isn't me. I was going to say earlier, like Captain Sheeks, I was wearing the same suit today. But thank you, members of the court.
Thank you, counsel. The court thanks counsel for both parties. The case is submitted. The court will be in recess until 10:30.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 10:30.